Fighting well is the pursuit of a lifetime. You may be at mile marker one of this wonderful life journey and thinking for the first time about embracing the life of a writer. Or maybe you're further along and ready to publish some of your ideas. I'm Melissa Parks with Dade Getz, and we are fellow travelers on this extended road trip to improve our writing and publish our ideas. We hope this podcast helps you make progress on your writing journey. Now, let's buckle up and write.
I listened to a TED Talk recently from almost a decade ago. The presenter was Dr. Henning Beck, who's a neuroscientist and a former Hertie PhD scholar at the Graduate School of Cellular and Molecular Neuroscience in Tübingen, Germany. He opens up the TEDx talk with two statements, and he says, "You can measure data, but you can't measure an idea. You can Google information, but you can't Google an idea." In this TED Talk, Dr. Beck discusses the uniqueness of the human brain, how it is different from computers, but why 70% of people, when they're given the question, "Where do you get good ideas from?" the most common answer is the shower. So creative ideas come often when we are most, and this is his point, inefficient, which makes us different from computers. We're relaxing, vacuuming the carpet, taking a run, and in my instance, fly fishing. So if you want to write a book that influences the world, you need to start with a creative idea, one that you develop as you write the book. And so as the book progresses, so does your idea. So great ideas form the essence of great books. And yet, idea development is one of the greatest struggles of writers with whom we've worked with through the years. And it is a great struggle. It's even something we struggle with when we write a script for a documentary or we help shape a memoir that we're ghostwriting for a founder and in our own personal writing. But in this episode, Melissa and I want to help you take your initial book idea or wherever you're at on that book writing journey and help you flesh it out, add to it, nuance it, expand it, illustrate it, prove it, maybe even apply it. So that's the agenda of this episode. But hey, before we begin, Melissa, let's begin with where you've made progress recently.
I've made huge progress in 2024 because I started out the year and a friend said, "What are you most excited about 2024? And I honestly could not think of anything. And this woman, my friend, is a life coach, and she just started a practice. And I was joking with her, like, "I should hire you." And one day I finally decided, you know what, I am going to hire her because I am so stuck. And I'm not a person who naturally makes lists and is very disciplined in most areas of my life. And so I thought, you know, this would be really good for her to help me determine what to focus on, how to achieve these goals that I seem to keep on just delaying making progress on. So it's been really fruitful. I've had three sessions and it's been a great journey because she breaks down my goals into very simple activities and asks me, "So what do you think you can do in the next 2 weeks to achieve this goal? And how can you set yourself up for success? And what can you eliminate that would be a distraction or keep you from doing that? What are some of the anticipated distractions?" So it's been very helpful for me to reframe beliefs and to identify in the moment when I'm getting stuck and then to push through.
Okay, so that was my question. So what has surprised you in hiring a life coach?
That I need accountability, that friends say they are great at accountability, but they pretty much suck at holding you accountable.
Friends suck at that.
And so,
and plus you don't want your friend doing that to you.
No, you just want to vent to them.
Yeah,
you want them
yeah.
to be the empathetic, sympathetic ear. So it surprised me how well I work when I have to report back and say, "I did this or I didn't do this." And the fact that I'm paying money for it and I'm telling my husband I'm paying money for it is this extra accountability. Like, I want to make the most of this engagement. And so I'm going to put my effort into actually doing what I say I'm going to do each week. So,
well, I'm encouraged with that in part because probably when I first started my other business, strategic marketing business, I hired a coach. It transformed my business. I wouldn't be here today, 20 some years later, if I had not had a coach. And it wasn't like they were cracking the whip on me, but it just, it kind of re-vectored my thinking and it gave me so much energy and it kind of made me realize some days, yeah, it's hard, but I'm not stupid. And it's supposed to be hard, and yet I can still do small things to get back on track. Okay, so my progress, my wife and I are in the process of eventually we're going to redo our kitchen. We have an older home, and the kitchen is horrible. And it just needs work, and it just takes a while to kind of even begin to think about it and who you're going to use, and maybe you need to have it designed first and where you're going to get your stuff. And it's an older home, so we're not going to put, you know, some top-of-the-line Amish cabinetry. Yeah, we're not going to do that, right? Because of the nature of the home. But we want to put in some nice stuff, but not too nice. We're frugal and we're just strategic, right?
That sounds like so much fun. I bet Jana is so excited.
Yes, she is. But today we have the plumber in the house working on our bathroom, not the kitchen. But it's kind of the first step. We had to replace all the hardware on our bathtub because everybody in my family is tall except for me, for me and Kira. So the shower head is never tall enough for all those folks. It's okay for me at 5'8", right? But the progress is we've got the plumber in, and as soon as you open up the wall and you start doing work, we're replacing a bunch of things, you realize there's other problems to solve. And so your $1,000 bill is now $2,000, you know, the drill. So anyway, it's all good. So the progress is making progress on the home.
So are you doing it because you want to enjoy your home or because you're interested in resale value, like you're looking ahead 5 to 10 years from now when you might make a move?
We're doing it for enjoyment.
Good for you.
For the moment. And we're careful enough not to put the wrong kind of money. This is going into kitchen and then we're going to expand. We have a half bathroom they're going to make into a full bath with a shower.
Yeah.
And so just those two things will increase the value. But that's not how we're looking at it. We're just like, hey, let's enjoy this. So, progress. We've made a little progress. Okay, we want to begin now with the most basic question, and that is, what is an idea? So what is an idea, Melissa Parks?
I will give you a simple definition. An idea refers to a concept, theme, or central point that serves as the foundation for, in our case, a piece of writing. At Journey 66, we like to think of an idea as a thesis, and we consider a thesis comprised of two parts, a subject and a complement. And a subject, you've probably heard us talk about this before, a subject is the topic that you're writing about. So Dave likes to write about fly fishing. I like to write about antiques. Somebody else may like to write about leadership, or there's just whatever it is, your topic that you are interested in. That is the subject. And then the complement is what you are uniquely saying about the topic, the subject that you're writing about. It's your unique take. It's what your idea is, and it's what is going to drive everything in your writing.
This is where I think all our writers, every one of them, I think, get stuck. They get stuck because they think that their subject is the idea for the book, and it's not. It's both, but it's really the complement that makes your book unique. What are you saying about your idea, right? And it's very specific. So let's talk about this. Let's go down into this next point that we want to talk about, that you have to be specific with your idea. So let me give you an example of that. I'm in the process of writing a book right now, and it's on fly fishing proverbs. What we're doing with this book is we're taking proverbs from legendary fly fishers, mostly dead, few who are still alive, that have really shaped the industry, just some quips from them, and then we're writing short essays on them. So I think it's a great idea. I've written about 5 or 6. But even with that, you have this proverb. I'm going to give you this an example of a proverb that I'm writing about. Here's a proverb. This comes from a woman fly fisher in the 15th century, by the way. And it may be the first recorded woman ever to talk about fishing.
Wow. Right,
that we know of.
Wow.
But anyway. So she says, and if the angler catches fish, "Surely then there is no man merrier than he is in spirit." So it's a quip, right? But the point here is that's the proverb. So my job now is to write a 500 to 600, maybe 700 word essay on that. And so the way I write, I want to tell stories. I want to make it fun. So my problem here is, again, not the subject, which is my subject is I'm going to write an essay that no one is merrier than a fly fisher who catches a fish. That's my subject. Well, if I start to write, that's not specific enough. I have to start thinking, how am I going to do that? Well, I want to tell stories. It's really in the compliment that gives me the specificity. What I'm going to say about why surely there is no one merrier than man or woman who catches, what that's what I'm going to say about. So what I say about that is what will make that specific. So long story short, I made the decision that the compliment to my subject is about what makes a man or woman merry, happy in spirit, is when the pursuit of catching fish, you lose track of time, and even the number of fish you catch doesn't matter, no matter how many you catch or don't catch.
What I love about that is your compliment is going deep into the subject, merriment, right? Happiness. And you're explaining what really makes somebody merry when they're fishing. And you're saying you lose track of time, you're in the moment, and that is the gift. That is what makes people merry.
In fact, I close the essay out with a story with one of the best times I've ever had fishing the Madison River. But here are two sentences that really kind of state my thesis within the context of the essay. Merrier is an odd old English word whose origin is tied to the idea of pleasure that is short-lasting and that which makes time fly. Time certainly flies when after only a couple hours on the river, I've lost count of how many fish I've released. I'm sated and merry in spirit.
I want to point out something, Dave, that I think is so important, is that you took the word merry and you did some research on the word. You looked at its origin and what does it really mean? You weren't just reading that quote and having a general sense. You went deep into the etymology of the word merry, merrier, and you got some nuance and some layers to your thinking simply by doing research, which is often what it takes to get more specificity to your idea.
This is a great moment to just pause and talk about that. When you're stuck, the best thing you can do is to step back and maybe do some more research.
If your idea is flat, if you can't answer that secondary question, what am I saying about the topic that I'm writing about, then maybe you do need to step back and do some research like you did. I think it's a really important point to make.
And what happens in that moment is you do some research and suddenly you latch onto a statistic that's stunning.
Or a quote.
Or a quote that you go, oh my gosh, that is exactly what I want to say. Sometimes in your research, you don't know what you're going to say until you see a quote and go, oh, that's exactly what. So this idea of being specific in your thesis development is really, really, really important. So just to say that all of us have, if you've ever gone to either high school, college, or graduate school, where you're adding content to a paper to reach a required word count.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there, Dave.
So they say, oh, you have to have 20 pages. You think, crap, there's no way I can do 20 pages. So I always started my papers about either 12 to 24 hours before they were due.
Sounds like me.
And I would sit, and back then I would just sit at the computer and I'd get all these research books out and I'd just start putting in quotes, and I'd kind of stitch the quotes together. And I would start at 2 p.m. in the afternoon and write till 6 a.m. I'd be so tired, but I had my paper done. I'd open up a bunch of sources, use a lot of quotes, summarize them, and they were really bad papers.
Because?
Because there was no thinking in them, and my idea wasn't specific. I was actually burping up all my research on the page, for starters. And here's the problem in graduate school, too, or in college, whatever. They give you, if you get the paper in, it's kind of a B.
Right.
Right? And most of these teachers are not even reading it. It's their TAs that are reading it, right? And most of them are tired of this. They may not even read. They may read the first page or two, and then they make a decision on which grade they're going to give you. So the point here is get specific. If you're going to write a book, get specific and go narrow.
I think it has to do with the difference between synthesizing ideas and interpreting ideas. I think when you're doing a research paper of the type that you're talking about, you're simply stringing together other people's ideas and then making an assumption based on what all of those combined say, rather than this person said this, this person said that, and my unique take on that is this. And you're doing the extra step of thinking and making it more specific. So there's this idea that you have to research, and then you have to do a lot of thinking to make your idea specific, to narrow your idea. It's hard to do. And I think that especially when you're writing a book, there's this fear of specificity because you think that if I'm super specific, then I'm going to lose a larger audience.
In addition to that, there's this fear of if I go more narrow, how am I going to get 10 chapters out of this?
What do you say to that person, Dave?
I say it's counterintuitive. The more specific you get, you'll go deeper than you've ever thought about it. And you'll end up writing a book that's really fresh because it will push you in ways that you've never thought of before. It gives you clarity. It will create originality by being more specific.
I have been thinking about this book that I want to write on creating beauty through vignettes and collections and the joy of collecting. And there are lots of books out there on collecting. I've done some competitive research, but I'm thinking in my take on it, I have been doing some deeper thinking on the neurology of collecting, the neurology of beauty, and connecting with the stories behind items and how that creates attachment to not just the things, but our homes and our spaces. And so that's forcing me to think much more clear about what I want to say. And it's making my idea original.
It is. Wow. I love that idea. Okay. So let's move into the whole idea of what you can do with idea. Let's say that you do have a really good idea for a book. It's mostly there. By the way, your idea, you're going to start out with an idea. That idea is going to change. And the more you start writing, you're going to go, no, that's not really what I think. This is what I think. This is what I think the real book is. So let that idea morph. But you need to start with a specific idea before you can get to the better idea. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's a scary moment for people, though, when suddenly their primary idea morphs and they're like, man, does all the work that I've already done, is it going to waste? But it isn't.
No, absolutely not.
You're just going to add another layer onto it to make it even richer and more specific.
So I read a biography of William Faulkner. I remember the quote from him, and he talked about the three things you can do with your writing. And it's really about how great writing happens. And apparently, when he was asked the question, he used these three elements, and then he put his hands together, overlaying his fingers, like it's integrated. You integrate these three things. And the first one is personal experience, right? Our own experience. One is observation of other people, of life. If you want to be a great writer, observe people. Observe smells, noises, how birds chirp. And then the last one is interpretation. And I just want to talk about interpretation just briefly, because I think one of the things I've experienced in working with writers through the years, I'm working with two right now, they struggle with interpretation.
Absolutely.
What does this mean, right? And I think they struggle with it because they feel insecure about that. And they don't feel like I'm an authority enough. So instead, they want to put a quote there from some book that came out or some research paper. But there's time for that. But then this moment of interpreting your idea is so critical.
I also think that people shy away from the interpretation because they haven't actually thought about what that quote means in the context of their larger idea or their thesis. So they throw this quote out there and they think that the person reading it will make the connection between the quote and the thesis. when they haven't, one, either thought through what that connection is, or it's loose in their mind what the connection is, but they don't write it down and say, what he is saying relates to what I am saying in this way, or supports this idea, or his, or you can do a compare and contrast. This writer in this quote is saying such and such, but he fails to say such and such, which is what my idea, what I'm trying to prove in this book that I'm writing. So it's this idea that you're just putting a quote in and you're assuming that the person is going to, reading it, is going to make this jump to what you're thinking about this quote and how it ties into your writing.
That's why you can put a quote in and you don't just move on to the next paragraph and don't say anything about it. You need to talk about why that quote matters to you, how it supports your idea, and maybe where it breaks down. And these are all ways to take one quote and get 1,000 words of copy on that one quote, right?
Well, it's like what you're doing with the word Mary. You took one small quote from this fly fisher, focused on the word Mary, and suddenly you have a 500-word essay, right?
Right, so exactly.
When you think about writing a book and filling a complete chapter of a book, that's a big job to be done. It's about 2,000 to 5,000 words, depending on the length of your book, unless it's a shorter book like yours. So you got to think in terms of sections, and this is long form, and it's the great challenge of long form is how do you take one idea and expand on it? And so this is one way you can do that. You can take a quote, you can interpret what it means and how it relates to your overall idea, but you can't just drop it in and then move on.
And I know many of you, maybe those of you who are writing, as you think about these ideas, that is one way to add another 1,000 words to your book. And it's real. It's the interpretation piece that adds the uniqueness, that it's really you on a, maybe it's a topic that's been run over a million times. But if you start to interpret that quote and start to run it through your filters, that's what makes that book uniquely you.
Right. And apply it even using stories from your personal life, or proving it with stories from your personal life, which is what we want to move into next. And this is, what are the three things that you can do with an idea? And this is something that you've probably heard us talk about before, but it's worth mentioning again. There are three things that you can do with an idea. And I'm going to list off the three things, and then we're going to go into depth and what these look like. The three things that you can do when developing an idea are, you can prove it, you can explain it, or you can apply it. And you can use these three things in a chapter of a book, in an essay. Certainly, you're going to be using it throughout an entire book to make the case for your idea. All right, let's start about explaining an idea. Dave, why should you start here?
Because often if you have a thesis and you have, let's say, chapter one, you might need to explain the idea itself. That's explaining. I would say explaining is probably the most boring part of writing. And if you're only doing explaining in your book, it's a pretty boring book, right? Because you're just kind of giving information. But explaining is important, right? And you can use things like illustrations and statistics and stuff to support how you're explaining it. That's different from what we're going to talk about, which is proving. So, for example, with Death by Suburb, I had to explain the idea that the suburbs poison the soul in a unique way.
And so you probably had to explain what you mean by poison.
What do I mean by soul? That's explaining, yeah. Right? You can't just assume they know what you're saying.
So one way to think about it when you're writing a book is you have this thesis and you need to define or explain what you mean exactly with the terms that you're using.
And often in books, in nonfiction, especially non-traditional fiction books, and there's a million ways to write a book, often one idea is to create that first chapter as your thesis chapter. What I have found in talking with acquisitions editors and my own experience with Death by Suburb, having published that with Harper, is if you get that thesis chapter right, they almost don't care about the rest of the book. That's not fully true. But the point is, in that opening chapter, you really have to explain where the book is going. And that's a legitimate thing that you do with an idea. You explain it. And there's different ways that you can support that with quotes and stories, but they're all about explaining that explaining that idea.
We're working with an author right now who is writing a book on mental health issues in family businesses. And the idea that they've gone largely unaddressed because it's something that family businesses don't want to admit to. They don't know how to deal with it. But the thesis of this book is that individuals are part of a family system, and sick or mentally ill individuals affect the family in a way that causes a breakdown of the family unit and then causes a breakdown of the family business. And so he has to explain this early on in the book. In one of the thesis chapters, I would argue, he has to explain the idea that mental health issues do not exist just in the individual. He has to explain that they exist in the context of a system. Then he has to explain what a system is, which is interdependency, that these two polars are always impacting each other, the family and the business. Then he even goes on to explain the reasons why families resist recognizing the impact of unwell individuals in their family. And then he has to explain what's at stake and the breakdown of the family. So this isn't proving, this isn't applying, this is just mere explanation of what's happening and why mental health issues have not been addressed up until this point.
Gosh, that is so good. And it's so helpful to me as I think about other projects that even I'm working on right now, is you just can't go into this idea thinking that you have to look at all the assumptions of your thesis. And that might give you all these different ways, like, okay, what, do people believe this? Yes or no? Why don't they believe this? And, or to, as you always talk about, the compare and contrast, what's the alternate to this? So, for example, the story that you're telling, the alternate is not to do anything, is to be quiet about this for a family. Well, that's unacceptable in theory, but it's what most families default to, right? We just don't want to talk about that hard stuff, which is, you know, Uncle Johnny, who's, you know, an alcoholic and yet CEO of the family business. And we know that it's hurting this or that, but nobody's willing to confront him or her. But it's a system, right?
It's a system.
It's a system. So that's very, very helpful. So let's talk. We've talked about explanation. And you say that this is where you break down the complexity of an idea into smaller parts, which I thought was really good. So let's talk about proving an idea.
You can prove an idea in multitudes of ways, which I find to be hugely encouraging, right? And that's what makes a book interesting, is if you use multiple ways to prove your idea. So you can do this through statistics, which is something that we learn in high school and through college. You know, you put a juicy statistic out there and then you interpret it. You use case studies, which are usually done through research or even personal experience. You get expert opinions, which we touched on earlier. And those are those quotes that you want to pull in and then extrapolate from. And you have historical references. And here's an example of a historical reference. So say your idea is eating a plant-based diet can lead to improved overall health and well-being. And a more specific one would be in your later 25 years of your life, like in your 80s and 90s. That would be even more specific. All right. But you might provide historical examples that show how different cultures and civilizations have thrived on plant-based diets throughout history. So, for instance, the longevity and vitality of a traditional Mediterranean diet, which is primarily plant-based, can serve as compelling evidence of the health benefits of plant-centric eating patterns. So you're drawing on historical to apply it to your idea.
What that does, again, is it gives you meat for this very narrow idea, right? So one of the concerns is, if I have an idea that's so narrow, but this is how you go deep into that.
I can even imagine, to go back to your example, the word Mary, I could imagine going and doing a deeper dive on that word historically and other people at that period of time who used that word and what context were they using it, and how is it similar to how this author is using it? And does it give new meaning to the way that you want to apply it to fly fishing? So there's just so much that you can do once you start thinking of all these different ways you can go deep into a topic. And ultimately, this is how you develop an idea and make it really interesting and layered and something that people remember, right? Because people remember the juicy statistic, or they remember the story. They don't remember generality. So it goes back to being specific.
Talk about using logical reasoning as it relates to proving an idea.
So logic is not my forte, but I'm going to give this a shot, Dave. So you've probably heard of deductive reasoning, which is going from general principles to specific conclusions. There's inductive reasoning, in which you go from specific observations to general principles. And then there's analogical reasoning, which draws parallels between similar situations. And so going back to this book that I just mentioned that we are consulting on, the thesis again is mental health issues do not exist just in the individual. They exist in the context of a system, and the individuals in the system are interdependent and always impacting each other. And issues that can threaten family unity and cohesion. And this can threaten family unity and cohesion ultimately. So inductive reasoning, which is where you start with a specific observation to general. So you start with the observation. This family member from a family business had a mental disorder and the family ignored it. And the disorder got worse in that family member and it led to problems in the family business. And then you notice, another member from another family business had a mental disorder and that family ignored it too. And the disorder got worse and the family business started to falter in these ways. So if you're a consultant, for instance, you're making these observations and you then can draw the conclusion, family businesses with persons with mental disorders that don't address the issues suffer. Deductive, again, is a little bit different. It's the reverse. So you go from general principles to specific conclusions. And so you have this hunch, right? You say a family business has unhealthy, underperforming leaders that lead to problems in the business. And then you go one step more specific. The person who is underperforming has a mental disorder. Oh, that mental disorder has been largely ignored. Therefore, you can conclude that ignoring mental health disorders in the family business can hurt the individual and ultimately the family enterprise. So again, this is just a way for you to take observations that you're making and then create logic to help your reader understand how you arrive at this idea.
And there's all these other things you can do. You can use personal experience, right?
Right.
To help prove an idea. You just say, this happened to me. And what's the basis of it's your personal experience that proves that this is true. You can use counter arguments to show this is compare and contrast in some sense. You use a counter argument, but then you come back and say, but this is true. And then the compare and contrast, which you just saw. Right. We did this on a book that we worked on, gosh, how long ago? It's been a while. On this obesity book, this diet mentality versus a non-diet mentality and how each of those play out. And then you make the conclusion that it's this diet mentality that actually prevents people from actually having long-term success and keeping weight off and feeling good about themselves.
Right.
So we talked about how you can explain an idea, you can prove an idea. Let's talk about the final one here. You can apply
an idea. So you can take some of these stories that, for instance, that you've collected maybe through research that you used to prove the idea, and you can also take those stories to apply your idea. So for instance, we worked on another book about family business succession, and the whole idea is that successors largely are in the shadows of the founder of the family business, and they don't have the internal credibility or external credibility to step out of the shadows and take the reins of the family business. And so the book then goes on to apply this idea through positive examples. So people who then gained credibility, how they were then able to lead as the next generation leader. So that would be applying. You would say, this is my thesis. People aren't able to take the reins because they don't have credibility. But if a person does have credibility, this is what it looks like.
And so this is what they do.
And this is what they do. So you're applying that idea.
We did that with the obesity book too. I remember that I think chapters 6, 7, 8, 9, the final four chapters of that book really applied her thesis to these different spaces, education, parenting, schools. And so you take your idea and you actually apply it to very specific situations. And honestly, it's the stuff that is most practical, most helpful, Because when you get specific on application, people read that and they take it away and it changes their life.
I would say that was a framework book, right? And right. So one way that you can apply your ideas is by developing an overall framework. And so lots of leadership books do this. Lots of diet books do this.
Yeah.
Health books. They say, okay, this is a new framework that I'm developing. And if you follow this framework, then you're going to have such and such positive results, right? And so in this obesity book, it was the unweighted model of health, which basically was, we're not going to focus on the thin ideal. We're not going to focus on dieting. We're going to focus on something which is living in this more healthy middle space of not indulging and not depriving. And if you follow this in all these different areas that you already mentioned, as a parent, as an educator, as a doctor, then you're going to have much more success. So that's a framework. That's how you apply an idea. You develop a framework and then apply it.
Well, we've come 1,000 miles, Melissa, in this podcast, and it's just, I just keep thinking about what I'm working on right now and how I need to go back and do all these things, especially approve, explain, and apply. Okay, so let's talk about how do you develop an idea for an entire book, like, or for a chapter, or for even a section within a chapter, or even a paragraph within a within a section, right? So let's talk about that for a little bit. So you say this, that idea development problems are closely connected to structural problems. And as we all know, structuring your book is the biggest and hardest challenge that you have as a writer. To me, it's structure is just, it's the bane of every writer. So let's talk about that. So how do you think through this idea for, let's say, your book?
So for a book, I think you need to follow the same principle that you would follow with even a smaller piece of writing, and that is to grab the attention of your reader.
Ooh,
before you even
so
begin
good.
To think about, am I going to apply this? Am I going to prove it? Am I going to explain it? You have to think of how are you going to engage the reader from the get-go? And so maybe it is an alarming statistic, or for instance, the obesity book that we ghost wrote, it was, I don't know, 10 pages of startling statistics about the dire state of our culture and our society and how much more obese we're getting and how much more unhealthy and how much more desperate and mentally challenged we are because we can't deal with this in a healthy way. So you grab the attention. But from there, you have to offer hope, right? You have to offer a way forward. And so in this case, it was, okay, we're going to paint the picture and how bad it is. But now we're going, and that's a bit of explaining, right? You're explaining the current state of things. And then you're going to go into this, but I have a solution. And this is what it looks like. And I'm going to prove why the previous way of doing things didn't work. And I'm going to prove why a new way of doing things does work. And then you can go into the application, like we mentioned already. So how does this new framework, this new way of thinking, how does it work out in the real world, in real people's lives? So I that's one way to think about developing an idea, but you have to think first, what's going to engage the reader? And then second, what does the reader need to know in order for you to begin to lay out your idea? So it's understanding your audience, right? And then it's getting really specific about what new idea you're presenting.
If I remember that book, chapters 1 and 2, if you want to think about the overall structure of a book, chapters 1 and 2, we're talking about the problem. Chapters 3, 4, and 5 was really introducing the new framework, the
right,
new model.
Right.
It took 3 chapters to do that, right?
Right.
And then chapters 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 were the application of this in these different spheres. So if you want to think about, that's one way to structure a book. But you said something that I don't want to miss because I'm in deep into this right now with an author. And we're talking about structure. And my rule of thumb is that every one of your chapters has to arrest me as a reader. Every chapter. And as I went through and looked at some of the structure, they were opening up with a long quote from some, you know, academic, right? I'm thinking, I would bail on this in a heartbeat. So you write in a book, you can simplify your structure by every chapter should have an opening, gripping story.
Right.
If you did that, mm-hmm. you would go 80% are where you need to go with this book.
Yeah.
The second thing you could do would be wrap up each of those chapters with the rest of the story from the opening chapter.
Right. Create that bookend cohesion.
Bookend each chapter. Yeah. Yep. So you're circling back to the story, because by that time you'll start to apply some of your ideas in that chapter to that story. Back to your point, though, just engage the reader. Lord, if I could preach that, you have to rearrest. I think you have to rearrest the attention of the reader. Every paragraph, every section, every chapter, you have to think as if you have to do it all over again. So that means your writing has to be interesting.
It has to be interesting. And the other point that I think we need to make at this moment is every section, every paragraph, everything that you're writing has to tie back to your thesis in some way. And this is one of the great transgressions of writers that we've already mentioned, is that you think that readers are going to make the connections back to your thesis. You just think that it's clear to you, but it's not clear to the reader. And so every time you make a new point, say it's in a section of a chapter, you need to somehow subtly, at the very least, say how this supports your overall thinking of your book,
exactly,
your idea. So you always come back to it. You mentioned the kind of the problem solution format for a book. There's also a common structure, which is the list format. That's what your Death by Suburb was.
Yep.
There are lots of list books out there. And this starts with an explanation of the thesis, right?
Right.
And then you had the, how many toxins?
Eight.
You had eight toxins that pollute the soul of the suburban person. And you go through then and apply your thinking to each of these toxins. You prove it, right?
Right, right.
You apply your thinking, and then you prove, you know, why this is happening, and that you're right, that there are toxins in the suburban living that that influence our spirituality. But the point is you're taking it back to your thesis every single chapter.
And let me just give you an example of, again, another project I'm working on right now with an author is, I told him, open every of your 10 chapters. Start with the story in every chapter. That alone will make me want to read this book. It has to be a good story.
And it has to relate to the idea.
Yeah, has to relate to the idea. But then you have what's called a transition paragraph or transitions paragraph, where you make the point of the story. I told you this story. Here's my point. Here's my idea for this chapter. And here's how it relates to the larger idea of the book. You can be that explicit and still be a good and still write scintillating copy. But help the reader with that.
What I hear you saying, it's push always for clarity.
Push for clarity.
Because you may have a beautifully written sentence, but if it's not clear, then it's not good writing.
Clarity is the single biggest gift you can give to your reader. If it's not clear, it's not worth reading.
People will abandon it.
They abandon it because there's just too much vying for their time. Before we close today, Melissa, when is my idea for my book not big enough for a traditional 250-page book or 300-page book or even a 200-page book? What happens, and how do I know that? Like, when does that happen, and what can I do about that?
So I think it goes back, do you have multiple sub-ideas to explore that support that primary idea, right? That either strengthens it, sharpens it, fleshes it out, makes it more nuanced, richer. Do you have subpoints to flesh that out, to flesh out your primary idea? That's one question. Then can you create a basic structure for your book that shows the progression of the idea through these sub ideas, right? And again, it has to do with, I think you're going to be identifying a structure as you go along, as you start to begin to identify these sub ideas. Like, is this going to be a problem solution book? Is this going to be a list book? And say you have a list book, but you only have two items in the list to support this bigger idea. You know, maybe that's an article and that's not a book. And that's all right, because maybe you just need to do more research. Maybe your life experiences aren't rich enough right now to support a full 250-page book. That's fine. There's no reason why you have to publish a book this year, right? It can be something that you always kind of have going on in the back of your mind and you're adding to in documents and maybe some audio files, and it will come eventually, right? But if you only have a couple of points, then you probably don't have enough for a book.
I was just reading the reviews on Goodreads for a really popular business book, and I won't say which one it was, but the rip on it, and it came through in several people in their comments, was this was really an article, not a book. He had one idea, and he could have done this in he did it in two chapters, and the other eight chapters were like
engine run on.
Engine run on. We used to call this blow and go, like snowing. You snow your teacher with all this padded content. Yeah. And it wasn't crisp enough. And maybe you could argue he didn't develop the idea enough. It could have been developed more, but it was kind of a one idea, one chapter, two chapters, and that was it. So I think that does happen with book ideas. And I think you need to keep digging to expand that. And that would be an example of an idea that's probably too general.
And again, be specific. Dig deeper. It's going to make your writing actually more sustainable in the long run, because you're going to dig into things that nobody else has said before, and you're going to make observations, and you're going to find quotes and apply them in fresh ways, or you're going to prove things in fresh ways if you have a very specific, narrow idea.
One last bullet point to what you're saying is, I remember Seth Godin, who is that great marketer, once saying that once he found podcasts, he was able to do series on different topics that he wanted to do, that he wanted to go down and drill down into. And he found that the podcast format eliminated the need for him to write future books. Now, he still has written a book or two since I heard him say that. But it just goes to show that sometimes your ideas are not big enough for a book, and that's okay. Make them a podcast series. Maybe it's not just one episode. Make it a 5-episode series. Maybe it's an extended white paper. Maybe it's a 5 to 10 blog series.
Or a booklet like we're working on
now. Or a booklet. I think as we wrap this up today, I think that if you're struggling in this area, first of all, you're normal. It's what writers struggle with, is the ideas. And stay with it, right? And think through these different ways to add more content while going deeper into your idea and not trying to be more general. All right, so it's now time for words of the episode. So Melissa, you go first.
All right, my word is an adjective, and it's Elysian, E-L-Y-S-I-A-N, and it means blissful or delightful. When I saw this word, I'm like, oh, it reminds me of that quote in Gladiator, right at the very beginning when he's leading his soldiers into war. And he says, if you find yourself alone riding in the green fields with the sun on your face, do not be troubled, for you are in Elysium and you're already dead. So it comes from the word Elysium, which is also known as Elysian Fields. And it was paradise reserved for the heroes immortalized by the gods. So ancient Greek poets imagined it as the abode of the blessed after earth. So you use it, Elysian, the adjective, to describe blissful, what you would imagine feeling like if you were in this heavenly abode, immortalized forever. So here's an example that I found from Vogue. There's no shortage of Elysian Santa Barbara hotels in both the seaside city and its idyllic surrounding areas of Montecito and Santa Ynez wine country. So I love how they took that word and made it kind of popular.
Elysian.
Elysian.
That is it's a beautiful word.
It is a beautiful word. It connotes what it means.
Yes, Elysian.
Elysian.
Huh. So my word today is limb. Limb.
All right. What does it mean?
L-I-M-N. Limb. It's a verb. You just depict or describe in painting or words. So another definition is to suffuse or highlight something with a bright color or light. So I would say this, Cormac McCarthy limns a darker world in his novels.
I love it.
Another way would be the full moon limned the dark branches of the evergreens with a bright edge.
I love that. It's such a visual word.
To limb.
It's so visual. It's active and it's visual.
Yeah.
It connotes making something dark. Positive.
Yes. Yes.
So, which is, even though the darkness still lurks, there's a sense that there's action towards making something more positive or brighter. I love that word.
Melissa, this has just been a wonderful episode. I think we should do more of these in the future. What do you think?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I'm Dave Goetz.
And I'm Melissa Parks.
It's time to buckle up and write.